listening to The Pulse, URN's award-winning news show, where it's all about the news that matters to you.
Hello, I'm joined today in the studios by Lewis, Millie, Emma, Jasper, and I'm Charlie. But now we have a story about life expectancy and how we're all living past 90.
Indeed, that's what The Guardian's saying in this report. They say that life expectancy in certain parts of the world is forecast to exceed 90 years by 2030. Some scientists that were funded by the UK Medical Research Council and the US Environmental Protection Agency have predicted an increase in life expectancy in 2030 to start exceeding 90 years in women. Since the start of the 20th century had been that it would stagnate, with many countries predicting for a long time expectancies in the late 70s for men and the early 80s for women. These numbers might not be entirely accurate because there might be unforeseen pandemics, there may be climate change issues and natural disasters that affect these numbers. But most of the 35 more economically developed countries studied showed a significant rise, including countries such as South Korea, France and Japan, a country already grappling with a large ageing population. In South Korea's case, women born in 2030 will on average live 6.6 years longer than their counterparts born 20 years before. Men are also likely to live longest in South Korea, with 84 years expected in the Asian country, as well as in Australia and Switzerland. In the United States, they are slightly far behind in terms of their life expectancy due to higher obesity rates and some not being able to access healthcare. The authors of the research point to the drop in infant mortality and the improvement in nutrition in South Korea, which has largely avoided the Western trends of rising obesity rates. There are also fewer female smokers in the country, and other nations are given higher predictions based on high-quality healthcare. However, this good news causes problems for future policymakers who have to cater to the social needs of a growing cohort of elderly citizens across the Western world. The UK's health system has already exhibited many signs of stress even this winter, and this news will do nothing to ease those fears. So, whilst this is obviously fantastic news on in terms of healthcare and how we look after ourselves as we get older, in the developing world at least, do you guys worry about the sort of support you'll get from the state, jobs, housing, all those? Do you guys worry about that as we live longer?
Well, I work for a care company, and I know how expensive it is, because mine's a private care company, so I know how expensive that care is, and people need it later life. Like, there's so many ailments you can get, it's quite scary. But yeah, things like that are needed, and if you can't afford that care, you're relying on the NHS, and you know the NHS is struggling already, like, to add to extra ages on there. Like, it's going to cause more problems there.
I think whilst it is reassuring that people are living longer, like you said, Charlie, because the fact people are living longer, there's going to be more demand on the care service, and because it is severely underfunded at the moment, there's going to be risks for the future as to what will happen when you are older, unless we're going to have some kind of nice, really modern care system in the future, potentially.
Yeah.
It is quite a worry.
Yeah, like, I'm not suggesting, like, to reduce the life expectancy.
Yeah,
no. Like, I'm not saying we should have a cull or something.
I had to word the question slightly.
I'm just saying that we need to improve our current care plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think there's a risk in the future. I'm just thinking as a prospective mother, as a person who wants grandchildren, great-grandchildren, you know, what is the life there? You know, healthcare, how's it going to go about? How's education going to go? How's the housing going to go about? I'm actually worried about it and the risks that are actually coming about. So what will happen to my children and my children's children in, say, 30, 40 years' time? Will they have the appropriate needs? And be careful. Mm.
Well, it's interesting you brought up housing, because we're having a housing crisis right now. An extra population, obviously, with the ageing, is going to cause an issue with that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And also, in terms of holding up and being able to support us as taxpayers, us being able to support those people that will need care when they are older, that amount of people is growing and growing and growing.
I guess there'll be more people to pay tax, though.
Who, us or them?
Well,
because they were.
Well, who's
they
were, us and them? Well, I thought we were all the same people.
Well,
that's providing that the tax system will be like that in the future. We don't know what it's going to be like in the future.
Yeah, we don't.
I mean, in terms
of hypothetical,
like, yeah, they're all getting people will be getting older. They'll retire. They won't be paying as much tax as as they would if they were working.
True.
So we would be footing the bill, as it were.
Yeah.
And that amount of people is getting smaller, especially as the government is pushing to lower immigration, who can't. And if we lower immigration, less money that's coming into the public funds.
That's interesting. You say in the future, say a person lives 200 and right now they live to, say, is it about 80? Mm. What happens to their taxes and their income and their retirement age? What happens to that?
Perhaps we'll have to higher the retirement age.
Well, for us, we're already, we're like 40 years off retirement, at least 50 years. What's to say if that doesn't go to 80? And what if we
I guess if we're getting, like, if we're living longer, then we're healthier in the long run, so we should be able to work longer.
True.
Healthier, but we'll be happier.
I don't think happiness comes into it, really.
I mean, scientists have also predicted, I remember I saw it on a news article a long time ago, that in the year children born after the year 2000 in Britain have a 1 in 4 chance of living until at least 100. So that's 25% of kids. Yeah, I think it was 1 in 20. I think it was 1 in 32 for those born in the '90s. So I have a less chance, unfortunately. But my brother could live. He has 1 in 4 chance of living over 100.
Yeah.
How can we support that without changing things slightly? It does worry me what we'll be entitled to when we get older.
I do remember looking at a case study about China, how the age of death is actually higher and people are dying much, much later. And it's found that the rate of criminality and crime is actually prominent in the older ages, because they are actually quite bored of their life and they want to like they just want to explore and be adventurous and then do something interesting in their lives, so they go to crime. So what would happen to our children, do you reckon, will they go to crime?
I mean, I think that's a good point in terms of the fact that because older people often find it, if they've come out of work or if they've lost their job, sometimes they find it harder to get in because they want people who are slightly younger that can stay longer
it's
in the job.
It's very competitive, isn't it?
Exactly. Mm. And then that could lead to poverty in that sort of age group that are a bit older but not old enough to retire.
And people get lonely as well, especially when they're older, because they end up living alone, because others do die and they are left, you know, isolated. So perhaps we'd have to work on a social program as well.
Yeah, that's a very sobering thought, the idea that all your loved ones are going to die and you just live on.
On that note. Right, well, I think that's all we've got time for on that story.
The Pulse, the news that matters to you.
Now we have we're going to talk about something on the SU website. So they've currently introduced an infographic on the website, and it contains statistics on students at the university's habits or opinions on certain things, especially on the SU itself. Statistics in the graphic on the website include 82% of us are satisfied with housing support here. Apparently 7.6 out of 10 of students are satisfied with their course. 4 out of 5 students are active at least once a year with students' union activities. And statements such as, students in the UK feel more at home than international students. Undergrads feel more at home than postgraduates. On an average week, a student spends 9.25 hours studying/revising and has 8.5 hours of contact hours, whereas 5.5 hours socialising. 8% of students binge drink 3 or more days a week, and 40% of students rarely binge drink. Apparently only 4% of students spend more than 42 hours on academia a week. There's so many more, and a lot of them do come out quite well for the SU themselves. Even the negative comments, the wording is very much positive for the SU. It's a very good way of advertising what the SU does, in a way. And to be honest, some of the statistics are quite interesting. It tells you what international students say, tell us the main reasons that they get involved. Making friends through societies is 66%, contribute to the community through volunteering, that's 65%, and to get fit through sport, 61%. So it gives a round picture of an ideal student almost, and it also shows the SU as in a good light. But people have suggested that it doesn't represent the student body. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't involved in this questionnaire, and it's kind of been implied that this questionnaire was a very small body of students who've been involved in it and maybe pro-SU. So it's very interesting to see what you guys think of this. Do you think it is representative of you? Do any of those statistics ring alarm bells for you? Or do you think this is fair enough and it's very interesting and good for the website?
Well, I have to say, sorry, as you mentioned, Charlie, that you weren't involved in the questionnaire. I know nothing about it. I haven't heard anything about it. Don't know anyone who was asked any questions. So immediately that would make me think it's not entirely representative of the student body if, you know, only a small number of people were asked. And I think also, as we were mentioning before, it doesn't specify when it says, you know, 7% or whatever of students, doesn't say 7% of students surveyed, it only says 7% of students. So I think immediately that rings alarm bells for me and makes me think it's not an entirely representative survey, which worries me greatly, really, that the SU would do that, that they'd, you know, advertise themselves. I think that's a bit, just a bit worrying, really.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. We were discussing in the studio, actually, before we went on air, that we thought that the wording of the actual statistics were troubling because they didn't outline how many students were surveyed or didn't say that there was a limited amount surveyed. I mean, what do you think?
It does feel a little bit shifty, and there's just something that's not quite. It, as we said, if it were worded better, you'd sort of be like, okay, you can sort of take that with a pinch of salt. But the way that it's presented is very much, this is empirical fact. This is what 3% of students spend 42 hours of academia. They have, obviously, there wasn't many medics that
it
did
was,
this.
It was 4%, not 3%.
I'm sorry. Well, 1% more than I thought. But like the amount of, I would say that's a lot higher than that, just because there are a lot of contact hours, a lot of courses that have contact hours, especially in the sciences.
I mean, the binge drinking one screamed out to me.
Yeah,
only 8% of students binge drink 3 or more days a week.
I mean, yes.
Does it sound accurate to me?
None of the first years were taking this one.
I just think when you look at all the statistics that they have put up on this graph thing, they are all positive for the SU. None of them are drastically very negative. Like, so for example, the binge drinking, you've got kind of the portrayal of the ideal student. And then similarly with the only 4% having the 42 hours contact time a week, it's all about kind of portraying every student at Nottingham as kind of the happy. Ideal student, yeah. And happy, whereas the general consensus is that maybe not everyone feels that way.
I mean,
so, yeah.
There's an example of what you just said. So one of the statements is, the least satisfied with the welfare support provided were postgraduate students. However, the extent of satisfaction was still high. It's the added bit at the end that suggests that it's, you know, everything's okay, nothing to worry about, no areas to improve on. What do you think? You've been quite quiet, Millie.
I was interested to see how you said how it's positive criticism. Like, do you have anything to, like, a line or two to represent the positive criticism aspect of what you were talking about?
Well, what I just said, basically, was an example of it. I mean, there's loads and loads on here, so I can't really scroll right down. But, yeah, it also suggests that quite a lot of students understand things with the SU. So 71% of students are aware of the student union's remit. And I mean,
what does that actually mean?
The clueless faces in the studio kind of tells me that statistic is a little bit.
It's quite high, 71%.
Yeah. At least three of us should. I feel like we haven't been doing our homework properly for this.
But that's why this is very interesting and very interesting to debate about. But no, I think the general consensus there is that we're all a bit dubious of these statistics and we think the wording should have been better perhaps, but it is still interesting to see that
the statistics just don't seem realistic to me.
maybe not then.
The Pulse, the news that matters to you.